good horse, I call you my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you had taken from somebody else. And this we go right.
You're listening to episode 575 of Unwelcome Guests, from oily sands to greasy palms. I'm Robin Upton. This week we're focusing on Canada as an example of what free trade actually means in practice for junior partners to these trade agreements. In our second hour, we're going to hear extracts from a film, You, Me and the SPP, a film which came to prominence due to a short section which provided conclusive proof of the use of agent provocateur by the Canadian police. So conclusive, in fact, that they actually came out and admitted it after a few days of speculation on the internet. That may have contributed to the demise of the SPP, the Security and Prosperity Partnership, on which we had one show earlier, but it has its own category on the website. We don't celebrate too early because, of course, it's getting rebranded and coming back. And now we're going to hear from Maud Barlow. This is a recording from earlier this year by Red Eye Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
So why has there been so little resistance and why is there so little publicity about this? Well, there are two reasons that I think are important. The first is that the Harper government has been very careful to keep this thing as quiet as it can possibly keep it. Stephen Harper is no Brian Mulroney. Those of you who remember fighting the first free trade agreement back in the 80s will remember that no sooner had Brian Mulroney become prime minister in 1984 that he went down to New York and he spoke to 600 of blue chip audience, business audience, and he said, Canada is open for business. And they took out a 9-page color glossy supplement in the New York Times touting everything that was open that hadn't been open under those bad liberals, and basically just invited the business community to come into Canada and help themselves. That's where he announced the energy policy, which would mean that we were lost basically control over Canadian energy. It's now North American energy. That's where he announced the end of the Foreign Investment Review Agency. It's where he announced all the policies. And he used to say, give me 20 years and you will not recognize this country. He boasted about it. He said this was the greatest thing since sliced bread. This is not something that Stephen Harper is doing. He controls things very carefully from the PMO, and he has decided that we are not to know very much about anything, certainly nothing as complicated and as important and far-reaching as this agreement. And he's aided and abetted, let's face it, by a pretty right-wing media, mainstream media in this country that is not telling the story. And I remember the media, tugs of war, the debates and so on that we had about other trade agreements, it's been silent on this one. So it's a harder battle. It's a harder uphill battle to get this out there. The second reason is that I think many, many Canadians have a very positive view of Europe. And they think, well, isn't it good to diversify away from the U.S.? And also, Europe's cool. Europe's got better labor standards, better environmental standards than the United States. Isn't it a better place to have a trading partnership with? This is in many ways false, but even if it weren't false, one must remember that it's the business community of Europe and the business community of Canada that have cooked this up, and they have the exact same agenda as the business community of the United States and the business community of Canada when they cooked up NAFTA. These trade agreements are not about trade. They're about redefining the role of government and diminishing the scope in which governments and elected officials can operate. It is about creating a new kind of constitutional law over the domestic law that exists in our countries. And that's what it's about, no matter who you're trading with. But it's also important for us to know that Europe is going through a profound change. In coming together, the European Union signed an agreement on procurement, which is the model for what they want here. And basically that said that they have to allow the corporations and the private sector of each of the other countries in the European Union to cross borders as if there is no border, so that it's a seamless, open area for business. And to do that, they have moved to legislated public-private partnerships in all sorts of areas, from hydroelectricity to transit. They are privatizing their transit systems very quickly, to water privatization, to do this in public services. Europe is privatizing way faster than the United States. They're also going through this austerity struggle and these austerity measures. Last week we got a hold of a leaked document from the Central European Bank telling Italy what it has to do. You have to, and they gave them a list of all the things that they have to do in order to get relief from the bond crisis. One of them, of course, is privatizing their water, and this is after a year or 2 years ago, the Prime Minister of Italy had an edict that all the municipalities had to move to public-private partnerships. They actually had a referendum that undid that, saying the people of Italy overwhelmingly said, we want our public water back. We want to maintain control over our water. And here's the Central Bank of Europe saying, you can't have that. Doesn't matter what you want. This is the transfer that's happening, the transfer of power from people to these corporations through these austerity measures and through these trade agreements. So I think those two reasons, are the reason it's been so hard to get this information out. And so what we're doing on this tour, talking to people, getting this information out, is trying to build, or I shouldn't say trying, we are building a movement in this country to come together and say no to this agreement altogether. I should tell you that at their request, I met with all the ambassadors from Europe to Canada, including the invitation came from a man named Brinkmann, who's the EU ambassador to Canada from Germany. And I presented a very strong presentation to them about why we were opposing this agreement. And he said a very interesting thing in response. He said, we very much agree with many of the points that you've made around, you know, environmental sustainability and equity and justice and so on, because I talked about those as being core values. But he said, we are helpless. He said these words, we are, like everyone, are helpless in the face of economic globalization. Markets rule the world. There's nothing anybody can do about that. And what we're trying to do is take advantage or exist as best we can. And I said, that's pretty stunning coming from Germany. I mean, if you, representing some of the most powerful countries on earth, if you feel there's nothing you can do about financial speculation and, you know, hedge funds and the power that corporations and the banks and financial speculation have over your lives, can you imagine how the rest of us feel? You're saying there's nothing that can be done. There's no democratic way that we can reassert democratic control in our world. Now, Paul talked about public services and the threat to public services with CETA. I just want to add another dimension, and that is the threat to resources, to our potash and our fish and our uranium and forests and nickel and minerals and so on. Because the other thing that CETA is a grab for resources. Europe, being a superpower, is in a competition with another superpower, China, to seek and get access in a permanent way to the diminishing resources of the world. And so what they want through CETA is not only to get access to many of the resources that still may have some kind of local control about them, for instance, fishing. There are still rules here about quotas being given to Canadians. They want all that gone. But they want to lock in their permanent access to it through the investor state clause that, that Paul talked about, which is then if any government at any level says, well, you're destroying the local water system here, or, you know, you're not hiring local people and the unemployment here is very high, or the byproduct of what you're doing here is making people sick and we're going to change the rules, they would have the right to sue for compensation, including all future lost profit. They call it the right to profit. You need to know what this term means. It is actually a term used now in trade negotiations. You have the right to profit, and anything that comes in the way of that right to profit is challengeable. Same story on food, and I just remind us that since NAFTA was signed, 80,000 family farms in Canada went under, just as we all predicted at the time. The control over food, from the growing and the marketing and the production methods, all of it went from small and medium-sized family farms to these large corporations, and the statistics are extremely clear about who controls our food in this country. But that's not good enough for the Harper government. They're now offering up our supply, poultry, dairy, wheat board, supply management in this country, and they're saying to the Europeans, we're willing to give this up if you will lower your standards against our genetically engineered food and against our hormone-laced beef, because Europe has had higher standards around food. So this is the agreement that they've been coming to. So we're working with people who are concerned about these issues in Europe to let them know what the agenda of the Canadian government is, which, by the way, is they haven't hidden. This is a very clear and open statement. They're also looking to prohibit local food policies and practices. Some municipalities, hospitals, schools, so on, are now saying we will promote local food, we will promote local farmers. All of that kind of thing would be absolutely prohibited. And then they have on the agenda this issue of the right to water, or the right to access to water. The two biggest transnationals in the world are called Veolia and Suez. They're both in the top 10 corporations in terms of profits in the world. They are both from France, and they are behind CETA 100%. They have been behind this agreement from the beginning. They're not only going to be able to come in and challenge whenever there's any new investment, a new wastewater treatment plant being put in, whatever, that is going public-private partnership, they're going to be able to come in and bid as if they're domestic. But they're even going to be able to say that if a municipality says we don't want to go private, we want to maintain water services in the public realm, that is considered a monopoly and a barrier to their fair competition, their fair access to competition. And you should know that Alberta is the first province in Canada to move to water markets, and it looks like British Columbia is going to be the second, and we need to fight this very hard, because once you have a defined water as a saleable commodity, once you give these licenses, convert these licenses to water markets to be bought and sold on the open market, you have lost control of your water, and a dangerous thing to do in a world where with declining water stocks. CETA is the wrong model for a world hurting. I think in the end, if I had anything strong to say about it, and I guess I do have a few opinions here, I hope you're not mistaking that I'm against this agreement and hoping that we can do something with it. But most importantly, it's the wrong model. We are a world running out of fresh water, clean air, old growth forests. 90% of the big fish in the ocean are gone. You know, we're destroying our minerals. We're now into the next level of destructive energy production, from the tar sands to offshore drilling to fracking, and the destruction to the local water systems that creates. We have got to find another model, and we've got to get a hold of the power that is being given again through these trade agreements to these corporations. We won the MAI. We stopped the extension of NAFTA to the Free Trade Area of the Americas. We stopped the Security and Prosperity Partnership for North America. It's come back in another form, but we are continuing to struggle here. The World Trade Organization is on its knees, and this is because of the collective action of countries and civil society movements and working people around the world who said no to this model. And I mean, I remember being at the one of the WTO meetings where it collapsed. It was an African delegate who got up and said, "What part of no do you not understand? This is just not the way we're going to run the world. And the way you are handling us now and treating us with contempt and not letting us have something to drink or something to eat and putting us in these so-called green rooms and, you know, psychologically beating us up every day, that's not good enough. That's not how we're going to run this world. We are going to assert a new way of establishing what the values that I know are deepest in our hearts. I believe with all my heart that we are not a minority. We in this room, the values and views that we're putting here together are not a minority. I believe they are the majority, not only in Canada, but in the world. And yet we still... And yet we're still told that this trade agreements like this are none of our business, we're too stupid to understand them, we're not even allowed to have access to them. Well, the time has come for us to say no more, and I think it would be a wonderful, sweet victory to win this one. And I think if we can win CETA, which I deeply believe we can go on to win many, many, many other victories while we resist the agenda being put before us by the Harper government. I thank you, and I just tell you, if you get weary thinking that this is a lot of work and that it'll take the rest of our lives to begin, well, I would say yes, it's true, but what else have you got to do? Thank you.
Well, Maud Barlow may not. I've certainly got plenty of things I'd rather be doing than defeating the next bunch of tyrannical legislation. And that, I think, is what the Occupy movement is about. Not cutting one more head off the corporocratic hydra, but actually staking the thing at the heart and saying, look, we, the 99%, are going to do things differently. This is how. It's not just about who gets to have how much money. If we give decision-making to corporate greed, if we let the psychopaths and the sociopaths rule, then they're going to pursue a business as usual, don't rock the boat strategy, until the whole boat goes down. Some of the goings-on, which are still secret from most people, but which definitely deserve a wider audience, I would like to hear this kind of conduct discussed at the Occupy meetings. We're going to hear now, this is an interview from earlier this year with Martin Lucas.
Right now I'm joined with Martin Lucas. So Martin, just introduce yourself, please.
Sure. I'm an editor with the Dominion newspaper and an independent journalist.
Excellent. So I kind of brought you in here to talk about a recent article you wrote about the rebranding of the tar sands by the Canadian government in Europe. So kind of just give us the background info of, I guess, who in the Canadian government is doing this, and kind of what they're saying, and, you know, how are they trying to rebrand the tar sands?
Sure. Well, maybe just a few words about the tar sands themselves, though I'm sure your listeners know something about it. I mean, the tar sands are kind of a central piece in a global play right now for the dirtiest fossil fuels. Obviously, there's been a decline in easily accessible oil, and it's kind of, rather than leading to a shift to renewable energy, it's led to a kind of shift for a search for the most filthy fossil fuels and resources, and they're kind of the central prize of that kind of new frontier. And obviously the tar sands in Alberta are known as some of the most destructive, energy-intensive fossil fuels in the world. They trail only Saudi Arabia in size. Naturally enough, they come in for a lot of criticism from environmental organizations and others for not just their carbon intensity, but also, you know, for destroying one of the larger watersheds, for strip mining a huge area for poisoning native communities downstream. So in order to push this stuff, as the Canadian government is trying to do, they've started to engage in PR wars domestically in the States, and also now, as has come clear from released government documents in Europe as well. So on the basis of some access to information requests, I was able to discover that since about 2009, late 2009, the Canadian Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, working alongside Environment Canada, Natural Resources Canada, and the Alberta government, the Foreign Ministry of Canada has been basically running what they call a pan-European oil sands advocacy strategy. And what, when we look through the documents, what it basically comes down to is, yeah, as you said, it's a PR campaign on one end. And on the other end, probably even more surprisingly to a lot of Canadians, I think, they are basically getting cozy with the biggest oil companies in Europe, who they call in some of these docs, like-minded allies. I think Canadians would question why the biggest oil companies are like-minded allies to ordinary Canadians. Certainly to the Canadian government and the oil industry in Alberta, they are. And so over the last 2 years or so, this oil sands team, headquartered in England, but working out of six or seven foreign missions across Europe, has basically been running an operation that involves all these secret meetings with oil companies, basically spreading a green positive image to European parliamentarians, responding to negative media coverage, which they're very concerned about. There's a really interesting quote in some of the documents where these government officials are assessing the European scene, and one of them says the oil sands are posing a growing reputational problem, with the oil sands increasingly defining the Canadian brand. Now, Canada's not actually exporting any tar sands oil to Europe, so people might ask, why then are we so busy in Europe? The issue is that basically the tar sands industries are expanding massively. So basically Alberta has became kind of a laboratory for oil companies experimenting with tar sands. And now basically they want to export it everywhere. They want to take it to the Congo, to Russia, Jordan, Venezuela, Madagascar, Trinidad and Tobago as well. But the issue is that the road to these spoils leads through Europe, basically. Right now in Europe, and for the last 2-3 years, the EU has been trying to pass and work on and try to pass what's known as a fuel quality directive. And basically what that would do is it's an initiative to try to promote cleaner transportation fuels. And early on when they were developing this, they wanted to put a dirty label on tar sands oil. And what that would basically take into account the fact that it's much more carbon intensive. What this label would basically do is it would discourage and basically ban European countries from importing that kind of oil. So now, even though Europe doesn't yet import tar sands oil, and probably won't in the future, the Canadian government and the oil industry is very concerned that this could set a precedent in other countries and basically lead to a domino effect, that it would be followed in Asia, obviously where Canada wants to export a lot of oil, might even be followed in the States. And so that's why they've kind of started to move into Europe and to try to undermine this fuel quality directive. And in these documents, the fuel quality directive is definitely one of the main targets that this European oil sands team of Canada is most concerned about. They seem to have had some success, because it was reported in the British media just a few weeks ago that the British government, who had previously been supporting this campaign to promote this fuel quality directive, is now changed their tack and will be working to block the EU from singling out the larger carbon footprint of the tar sands. So they're having some success, which is disconcerting, and basically, social movements, And organizers need to redouble their efforts and remain really vigilant, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, when you say that there, I mean, reading the article and hearing you just kind of describe it, I mean, I understand that it's the Foreign Affairs Office, I guess, that is doing a lot of this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, like, so how many people are we talking about? Are they sending over to Europe? I mean, how much money? I mean, is this like a major undertaking by the Canadian government? Are they pouring in, you know, all sorts of people and a lot of money to this?
You know, it's not actually, which is interesting. I think from what I understand, they only have about a dozen officials working on this in Ottawa and in these 8 foreign missions. So that should be of some you know, comfort to us. But they are in the documents that I got, they are you know, constantly carping about how little resources they have and how they really need more resources. And so this has been run by the Department of Foreign Affairs, and it's officially, what we know so far is that it's not a cabinet, it's not run by the cabinet, it's run by the department. So there's no direct oversight from an involvement from any of the cabinet ministers. But, I mean, obviously with the new Harper majority, it would seem likely that they would start to pump a lot more money into these kinds of initiatives. And even with these 10 officials, they have been able to coordinate a lot of really high-level visits that have happened. So, for instance, companies like BP, Shell, Total, the big French company, and the Norwegian State Oil regularly meet with ambassadors, with the heads of these foreign missions from the tar sands group. And it's run to the very top. So, for instance, Canada's Prime Minister, Stephen Harper himself, he met secretly with with Total CEO back in June 2010, right after he went on a publicized, we went to have a publicized meeting with French President Nicolas Sarkozy. So he was there for a few hours just before the G20. He seemed to find time to meet in secret. And since then, Total has announced plans to pump, I think, about $20 billion into their Alberta projects by 2020. So we don't yet know what transpired at these meetings, but it's clear they must have had some impact. And I would think that you're going to see an escalation in these kinds of tactics, especially with Harper looking obviously to appease some of his base, which obviously is located in Alberta, and a lot of backers in the oil sands. And I think these kinds of campaigns are part and parcel of the expansion of the tar sands that he would like to oversee. And that involves obviously the pipeline corridors down through to the States. That's the Keystone XL pipeline. Enbridge, of course, wants to build their pipeline through the Gateway pipeline through BC, through a lot of unceded indigenous territory. And Enbridge also has plans to reconvert some of their pipeline corridors that exist to the eastern seaboard. So obviously, Harper knows that to ensure that this happens, because there's been a lot of environmental and indigenous resistance to these, to make sure that it happens, they need to play the PR game a lot better. There was a WikiLeaks as well, which was interesting, that came out a few months ago. It was a WikiLeaks about that described a meeting between the former U.S. Ambassador Jacobson and the then Environment Minister Jim Prentice. And Prentice had, in the summer of 2009, gone to Norway, and he basically, this WikiLeaks described how he was literally shocked at the kind of public debate that was happening in Norway around divestment, around state oil divestment from the tar sands. And he basically indicated that he felt that the Canadian government really hadn't done what they needed to sell the tar sands, and that it was really damaging their ability to sell the tar sands, and it was really having a toll as well on these European companies who they rely on for investment in the tar sands. I think we should expect that domestically and internationally, these kinds of PR wars will just escalate.
Right. Well, I mean, the one interesting thing that I thought of too was that through these PR wars, from what I understand, Canada's reputation internationally has kind of fallen off a bit, and I think, from what I understand, a lot of that does have to do with the environmental record. So it's kind of fascinating that the Harper government would, it seems, trying to go put more resources into this PR campaign. What are they thinking here? Is this kind of go for broke, I guess?
Right, right. Yeah, no, I think you put it well that they are, it seems like they are going for broke. I mean, obviously the issue is not a PR issue. It's an issue of a disastrous environmental record. So one would think that one could just work on that environmental record, and then that would be the best way to fend off the critics. But I really think, like, yeah, the tar sands are simply indefensible by the record, right? And the oil industry in Alberta and the federal government and the Alberta government have shown no signs whatsoever of wanting to deal with the issues. Their concerns are making exorbitant profit of turning Canada, as Harper says, into a global energy powerhouse. What that basically means is turning us into a third world pump, energy pump for the United States. And if they can have their way, then for other countries as well. That remains the core of the issue, really, is slowing down the tar sands, implementing some kind of moratorium for the tar sands industry. But I don't think the government is, and the industry is, willing. I think the fact that they're escalating this PR war can be seen as a reflection of the successes of environmental critics and of political movements who have really been kind of raising these concerns on the international scene and rightfully sullying Canada's reputation. So I think Canada has seen the damage that these groups and organizations, often Indigenous-led, seen the kind of consequences of these campaigns, which rightfully point out the record that Canada is setting. Mm-hmm. And so rather than deal with the substantive issues, they're just ratcheting up their PR campaign. Not just within Europe, but also, you know, adopting absolutely absurd language around Canada, Canada being an exporter of quote-unquote ethical oil, which is Ezra Levant's name for it.
Right.
I mean, whether or not it's a liberal democracy or a dictatorship presiding over the extraction of this oil, the extraction of oil itself is still a environmental disaster. And that is the issue. But basically, I think that in some ways this PR war is an indirect nod to the successes of some of the oil sands opposition and resistance.
Yeah.
It's quite exciting, I think, that Enbridge seems quite unlikely to be able to push through their pipeline, their gateway pipeline. I mean, even a very conservative political risk consultancy group like Eurasia recently acknowledged that First Nations opposition may be insurmountable. I think their quote was something like, their exact quote was something like, native land claims scare the hell out of investors, and they're going to knock down the confidence they have in this pipeline. Obviously, the pipeline down through the U.S. heartland, the Keystone XL, has faced a lot of resistance. Right now, it's being reviewed by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. The push for the fuel quality directive. I mean, Canada actually succeeded last year in getting the EU to remove that label, but thanks in large part to green organizations, to indigenous groups who have been campaigning throughout Europe, they have now kind of stiffened their spine and reintroduced the dirty label distinguishing tar sands oil from other fuel sources. And they should be implementing that hopefully by the end of this year or in the fall. So that's a hopeful sign as well, mm-hmm. that despite all this PR campaigning, despite the efforts of oil companies, opposition and organizing is working.
I mean, but is it just because they haven't been able to go full bore into this, as you've kind of pointed out before, that it's we have yet to see the full force of this PR campaign and the weight? I mean, if you think about it, if it's the Foreign Affairs Office that's doing it, I mean, they could quite literally use the weight of the Canadian state against. You know, so, I mean, is it just that we haven't seen what they really can do?
Well, I think one part of it, I mean, you know, that this, I mean, this was a secret, it was like a secret operation, right? The Canadian government wasn't openly publicizing this tar sands advocacy strategy. So I think that's an indication that they know that if they basically go above ground, it will further embarrass them. So I think, to some extent, they're reluctant to go public because they know that it's going to cost them as well. But on the other hand, I don't think we should discount that the oil companies in Europe are already doing a lot. Like, you know, companies like Shell, companies like Total, they spend, you know, in excess of 500,000 dollars a year lobbying just EU parliamentarians. So I think Shell is something in excess of $1 million just on lobbying around basically this fuel quality directive. So there, but you know, I mean, like, no, the public has no real confidence in oil companies, and so oil companies kind of do these things quite shamelessly. The Canadian government knows they have to proceed with some amount of caution, at least when it comes to basically cozying up to oil companies. I think because of the strength, it's precisely because of the strength of environmental activism and organizing that they haven't been able to go public with this kind of stuff. So it's kind of a precarious kind of dance that the Canadian government involves itself in. But we'll see. I mean, I'm interested to see if they do ratchet up in a public way. I think they'll continue to do what they've done, what oil companies have continued to do, which is, you know, muddy the water, set up all kinds of false grassroots organizations that try to pretty the image of the tar sands. They know they can't do this publicly, right? I mean, try to hire lobbyists that do that kind of work. So, for instance, one of the other things that was revealed in these documents was that the Department of Foreign Affairs considered hiring a PR company to advise it and also to do work on these issues on its behalf. So that seems to me a real possibility. In the upcoming year or two, that they will have PR companies doing their dirty work, basically.
And I guess almost to rephrase the last question then, I mean, like I was talking about them not using the full force, and it's essentially they could use the weight of the, you know, Canadian state, to push this. And although you've pointed out that, you know, what we've seen, this reaction is, a direct result of the success of grassroots movements, but also with, as you also just pointed out, them setting up fake grassroots organizations, do you still have the confidence in to put it in one neat term, people power, to kind of stop this?
I think that's the only thing we can have confidence in, I think it's really important to be as clear and lucid as possible as we can be about the political terrain. and the forces that we're up against, forces that have millions more dollars, that have the state apparatuses that we're, that we've been talking about, a diplomatic, corps that can, you know, descend on these European capitals. But I think that's the only hope that we've ever had, and, I'm quite confident that with diligence and determination, these indigenous communities that are resisting tar sands expansion, these environmental organizations that are working alongside them and campaigning in the States and Europe, and at home, can have a real impact. I'm really excited about the what's happening in BC right now. You have a company that has sunk billions, that wants to sink billions of dollars into the Gateway pipeline, and they are meeting against very unified, strong resistance from 60 First Nations communities. And I don't see how Enbridge could get through that kind of resistance. And in Europe too, there are a lot of grassroots organizations who are, as we speak, mounting their organizing against Canadian and oil companies' efforts to undermine the fuel quality directive. Mm-hmm. So I do have a lot of faith. I think without a recognition of the gains that have been made, and that have only been made by grassroots movements, by people power, mm-hmm. I think we're lost.
Right. Amen, of course, to the idea of people power. That's something our next speaker doesn't salute as much. He talks about the left and the right wing, reflecting the fact that he is inside the political machine. So this is Peter Julian of the Canadian NDP Party. He's an MP being interviewed by Maggie Hughes. This is an hour's interview, but we're going to hear a section of it because there isn't time. The full interview is available on our webpage for download, unwelcomeguest.net/575. And this is from earlier this year.
So what's happening is Canadian families are working harder and harder. They're getting paid less and less, and they're taking on more and more debt just to make ends meet. And this is a direct result of the economic policies, including the trade policies, that Liberal and Conservative governments have brought in.
Exactly.
And this is something that Canadians need to be aware of, that
sure.
These trade and economic policies are designed to make the wealthy extremely wealthy and to make most of us very poor. So when we talk about free trade, the name free trade is an oxymoron. It's trade that comes, these free trade agreements come at a tremendous cost to the middle class and to poor Canadians right across Canada.
Can you give us an example of one trade deal from sort of start to finish, the result of it on Canadians or a Canadian company?
Well, I'll just look at, I can give you the what we've uncovered, and this is something that we couldn't even get from the Minister of International Trade. We asked for months and months to get the actual export figures in real terms after we've signed particularly these bilateral trade agreements,
mm-hmm.
and the Ministry of International Trade would never provide it. What they do is they provide figures that are done in, they're not done in real terms, so what happens is they show an evolution of trade, but based on inflation devalued dollars. Of course, as we all know, I mean, your dollar's not worth the same from year to year, so if you try to pretend that dollars in 2010 are worth exactly the same as dollars in 2000. That would be really misleading to people. But that's what the trade ministry does. It gives figures pretending that dollars in 2010 are worth exactly the same as dollars in 2000. And we said, well, no, you've got to have dollars that have the same value, and that's the only way to determine whether our exports are going up and down. The trade ministry never provided these to us, so we had to work through Statistics Canada and the Library of Parliament, and we got the figures back and exposed them to the country. Now, the big media, of course, isn't willing to to publish these figures because they're very controversial. What it does is undermine the entire basis of this right-wing approach to trade. But what has really happened when you look at the real figures is that our exports have gone down in virtually every market mm-hmm. where we've signed a free trade agreement. The exports from that country to Canadian markets have gone up in virtually every case. But in Canada, with one exception, after signing trade deals, our exports to those markets have gone down. In some cases, they've varied. They've gone down, they've gone up, they've gone down, they've gone up. In some cases, over time, they may have come back to the same levels they were before we signed the agreement. But in every single case, they did go down after signature, which shows that these trade agreements aren't about exports. They're not about building markets, that there's something profoundly dysfunctional about Canada's trade policy. When you sign a trade deal, and our exports to those markets go down, you have to ask the question, then what are these trade deals doing?
We aren't building more factories. We aren't making more jobs. We're not, you know, I don't know if they're outsourcing labor or what they're saying, but there's no labor.
Yes, they're outsourcing labor big time. Hamilton and other areas of southern Ontario and across this country have been impacted by loss of 500,000 good manufacturing jobs. These are family-sustaining jobs. These are the kind of jobs that our parents were able to have and to raise families with. And instead, they've replaced them with burger-flipping minimum-wage jobs that people can't raise families with. And then we wonder... And the big media companies that support these incredibly asinine trade agreements with a hard right-wing agenda, and the big media companies wonder why there's 300,000 people seeping out in the streets and parks of our country, and why families are carrying record levels of debt, and why so many families are living basically week to week and could lose their home or lose the roof over their heads if they get laid off or they get their hours reduced. I mean, we're talking about economic inequality and economic mm-hmm. precarity like we haven't lived through since the 1920s.
That's right.
Takes us back to before the Great Depression.
Right.
CBC or CTV, and you listen to the radio and you read the newspapers, it's as if they are completely oblivious to what is actually happening in
most
Canadian lives.
Well, you get little bits, but you don't get an understanding. There are so many people in Ontario that are homeless. It's not a secret anymore that something's really functionally wrong with Canadian government, with what's wrong with the trade deals, the job deals, foreign ownership that comes in. They sign whatever agreements, but they don't seem to stick to them, and nobody seems to care. As you said, Harper says, well, I'm stuck with these previous agreements, and I think he's referring to NAFTA, previous agreements where I can't pull the strings loose from these deals. You know, I can't step in and stop them. Well, that's what the government is supposed to do, is to give a safety barrier for its own citizens against corporate rule and corporate gluttony in their own country. But Harper's busy talking about starting jobs for mid-sized businesses or smallest businesses in some other country in the world. It's like, does he think he's prime minister of the world and he's trying to help some other small third world country? We are a third world country now.
In terms of income inequality, we've turned the clock back generations, and that's absolutely undoubtable when you look at the real figures about what's really going on. And the other aspect, of course, which mirrors, as you say, Maggie, the sort of third world economy, is we're shipping record levels mm-hmm. of raw resources out of the country. Now, that means raw bitumen, that means raw logs in British Columbia and Northern Ontario. It means that the resources, Canada being one of the wealthiest countries in the world for our natural resources, Canadians aren't profiting from that because we're shipping them out.
That's right.
So that cheap labor elsewhere can, there are a few jobs available, but at much lower wages. And then a few investors on Bay Street in Toronto reap all of the benefits resources that we have in our country. And this is why I think more and more Canadians are saying there's something fundamentally wrong. When one of the richest countries in the world is getting poorer and poorer as far as the middle class is concerned, far as poor Canadians is concerned, what we're seeing is massive income redistribution and Canadians having to scrape just to make ends meet, land of plenty.
We're being massively deprived of our basic rights to live, to eat, to have housing. I refer to that as domicide, when something's done purposefully that makes its citizens become homeless. It's just the same as a genocide. It's just a different word for it. We were never, ever thinking about allowing foreign companies to own our trees, to own our water, to own, well, the mineral resources. And it's been going on since the 1980s or longer. It's been planned since the 1960s. It's a constant with, well, if you follow Harper's path and his connections, and you include the Liberals in this as well, because the trade deals are the same, and you said it's a template that they're both using.
Yeah.
The template, can you explain that template in a way that anybody will understand how it works? I think people understand how it doesn't work, but explain to them why Harper thinks that this is a good template.
Well, and this gets us into a bit of the debate now around the Canada-European trade agreement, because one of the worst aspects of the trade template in Canada is the so-called investor state provisions. Now, what that means is basically for any government or state decision that's made, and that can be a national government decision, it could be a provincial government decision, it could be a municipal government decision, the corporations now have the right to sue in their own sort of corporate courts and get compensation from the taxpayer if in any way their right to profit is impeded. It doesn't even mean that the company has had any of its properties expropriated or any of its properties in any way impacted. All they have to do is suggest that in some way their profits have been impeded and they can sue Canadian taxpayers. Now, of course, that has an impact not only on when policy, environmental policy or social policy is brought in. It also means that the natural democratic sense of checks and balances that a city council in Hamilton or the Ontario provincial government or Canada's parliament can make a decision, and if it's in the best interest of the people, then that decision then is implemented. With these investor state provisions, a corporate CEO now has the ability to say, oh, you want to bring this in? Well, you're going to have to pay us first.
That's
and
right.
What we're seeing is the corporate sector is now using this in a very, very big way. And I'll give you two examples if you like, Maggie. First, we have Ethel Corporation. Now, Ethel Corporation is a corporation that manufactured a neurotoxin, a gasoline additive called MMT. And no one questioned the health impacts. This is a horribly toxic product. And the Canadian government said, well, we're going to have to ban this product, of course, because it has impacts right down the line, health and safety impacts on children, on pregnant women, on Canadians generally. Well, Ethel Corporation got $13 million from Canadian taxpayers and the people listening on our program today and Canadians right across the country as compensation for manufacturing a bad product that the government then banned. It's ludicrous when you think about it. Let's say somebody robs a bank. That's the equivalent. They break the law. They rob a bank, and it's the equivalent of the government and taxpayers having to compensate that person because the government said, well, no, you're going to have to go to jail for robbing that bank.
Yeah.
This is what the corporate sector now gets. No matter how egregiously bad their product, they can seek compensation if it impacts on their company profits in any way.
Yep.
And let me give you another example more recently. Abitibi Bullwater, which is this company in Newfoundland and Labrador that has had longstanding timber and water rights in Newfoundland and Labrador in exchange, because those are rights that are granted by the people of Newfoundland and Labrador,
right.
They got these rights in exchange for operating a mill. Well, the company changed its owners some some new company owners decided that they didn't want to keep their end of the bargain anymore, and they shut down the mill, throwing everybody out of work. And the Newfoundland Labrador legislature made the decision that they were going to withdraw their timber and water rights. I mean, that was part of the deal that the company had signed. So it made absolutely eminent sense for the legislature, the people of Newfoundland Labrador, through their elected representatives, to say, well, you're not keeping your end of the bargain, so we're taking back the rights that we temporarily gave you in exchange for operating that mill. Abitibi-Bowater then used the same provisions, these investor state provisions that are in Chapter 11 of NAFTA, and said, no, we're gonna sue you now, because even though you're making a decision in the public interest, in some way you're impeding our profits. So the taxpayers, again, the people listening and right across, Canadians right across the country, had to cough up $130 million in compensation to Abitibi-Bowater for not keeping their end of the commitment that they had made. The company broke its word and gets money from Canadian taxpayers in exchange for doing that. It's absurd. It's absolutely outrageous. Yet this is what is contained in every single one of the...
Well, the NAFTA ideas, it started with Brian Mulroney with the FTA, was built into NAFTA.
Yes.
Nobody wants to untie those strings, because why?
Well, because the right-wing politicians like the fact that their corporate buddies get money anytime a government makes a decision in the best interest of the people. It's like a democratic override. From now on, whenever governments at any level do anything, they are subject to somebody walking up and with their hand out saying, you want to do this, you want to protect the environment, you want to... establish social housing, you want to establish an effective job market in Hamilton, well, you're going to have to pay us first. And it's absurd. No other country in the world has it as part of their trade template. After NAFTA, in fact, the United States government moved right away from investor state rights and has subjected the ability to seek compensation by companies to a whole range of things that come first. For example, environmental protection, health and safety measures, the public interest, all of those come first. So if those are the things that are behind a government decision, you can't sue the U.S. government. You can sue Canadian governments for anything. It's just a blank check for corporate CEOs. And, of course, corporate CEOs, they're not thinking in the public interest. They're thinking of themselves. And if they can get easy money out of the Canadian taxpayer, they'll do that. Just to finish off on Abitibi-Bowater, because this is one of the most outrageous things.
Right.
Abitibi-Bowater shouldn't even have been able to use this clause, because it's supposed to protect foreign investors. It's
right.
A Canadian company. So what they did is they used a mailbox in Delaware and said, oh, we're a company in the United States now, and used that to shake down Canadian taxpayers for $130 million, and conservatives and liberal MPs support that 100%. It's outrageous, and these are the kinds of things which is why so many people around the world look at the Canadian trade template and they are aghast that we have turned over our whole trade agenda to these incredibly right-wing, mean-spirited provisions that do nothing for the public interest or the public good.
It has to come out. I know Danny Williams out there, he tried to stop it. He got some news coverage. How do we stop it? How does the citizen, the working person or the unworking person, stop it? I mean, shows like mine help to get it out to many different universities so that people can hear, okay, here's what's going on. Here's what's happening with these trade deals. Here's the template. Here's how it's set up so that we can't win no matter what. We can't fight back no matter what. How do we stop it then?
Well, by standing up, we've stopped a number of these agreements and these negotiations. Most recently, the Security and Prosperity Partnership. Now, that was something that was brought in by George Bush and the Liberals, and then Stephen Harper, of course, supported it. Now, I was at a public meeting that was sponsored down in Hamilton by the three hardworking Hamilton MPs, and they did a terrific terrific job of sponsoring a public meeting. It was a standing room only crowd there. And what we saw is that people were willing to speak up And they were willing to come out.
Who was the press that was attending that meeting?
I don't recall who the media were. I do recall that as a follow-up, a lot of people were writing in to local papers, and
okay.
And the fact that Hamiltonians got involved, as well as many other Canadians right across mm-hmm. the country, did make a difference, and we were able to stop that agenda, working with our allies in the United States and Mexico. But there's an example of a situation where the fact that people were willing to speak out made a difference. And so it's, I think, a case where we all have to speak out. We all have to get organized. We are winning, I'd say, more and more of these battles. But the fact that people are willing to get involved